matter what hour your clock strikes, here it's always Halloween. And I'm always your haunted host, Luce Tomlin Brenner. So far in our chapter on skeletons, we've tracked our morbid fascination with bones and skulls back to the ancient Celts. However, we discovered it wasn't until the Black Plague of medieval times that we got our first skeleton art. Those images from the 14th century are so haunting that we still use them today when celebrating Halloween or engaging with horror fiction. So, how did these lovely bones travel over 600 years, staying firmly implanted in our consciousness? Well, the easy answer, of course, is that death is frightening, and skeletons are the rawest image of death, so naturally they became a Halloween staple. But I like to dig a little deeper than 6 feet on this podcast. Oh, but first, did you know the phrase 6 feet under also came from the Black Plague? Not the original occurrence in the mid-1300s that we've been discussing on the podcast, but from a 1665 outbreak in England. As the disease once again descended upon the country, the mayor of London created the six-foot law to mandate how bodies were buried to avoid further infections. But it didn't stick after the plague passed. I had always assumed 6 feet was the norm, but modern American burial laws vary state to state, and many states simply require a minimum of 18 inches of soil on top of the casket or burial vault, and only 2 feet of soil if the body is not enclosed in anything. Very fun fact for those who already felt that death was lurking too close. And speaking of lurking death, let's get into memento mori and the role this ancient philosophy played in keeping skeletons fashionable. Memento mori is a Latin phrase that translates into remember death or remember you will die. Similar to the danse macabre of the 15th century, memento mori urges you to remember death so that you can truly live life. Modern folks often refer to memento mori as objects, like remembrance jewelry. But like most things related to Halloween, it's an idea that dates back to antiquity, and it's been a central theme in much of our philosophy, literature, and art for the last 2 millennia. Memento mori seems to date back to the philosophers of Stoicism, a school of thought that thrived in the Greco-Roman world from the 3rd century BCE until about the 3rd century CE. According to the DailyStoic.com, the Stoics used memento mori to invigorate life and to create priority and meaning. They treated each day as a gift and reminded themselves constantly not to waste any time in the day on trivialities and vanity. In his book Meditations, Stoic philosopher and Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius wrote to himself, "You could leave life right now. Let that determine what you do and say and think." Excavated mummies, tombs, and pyramids reveal that remembering death was also entrenched in nearby ancient Egypt. Egyptologists maintain the preservation of dead bodies and the building of elaborate death chambers were an act of celebrating life and a reverence for its ephemeralness. Memento mori has also thrived in Christian philosophy as well. However, in that context, it serves a more moralizing purpose. In Christianity, death serves to emphasize the emptiness and fleetingness of earthly pleasures, luxuries, and achievements, underscoring the importance of focusing one's thoughts on the afterlife. We can see the link between skeletons and memento mori in the European carved cadaver monuments found in churches built during the Middle Ages. According to the book Dealing with the Dead by Christina Welsh, cadaver monuments are three-dimensional sculptures that are a part of a Northern European genre of mortuary art called transi, meaning passed over. This includes incised brasses, carved skeletons, carved rotting corpses, and carved intact corpses. These monuments portray wealthy landowners, prosperous merchants, and high clergy members lying naked and emaciated in open burial shrouds. Cadaver monuments remained popular through the medieval era into the early modern period, which lasts from about the 1500s to the 1800s. No longer satisfied with large-scale depictions of skeletons, 16th century artists began incorporating skulls into jewelry. Death you can wear! Many rings of that period doubled as both wedding rings and a memento mori. On our Instagram, I'll share a picture of one skull-adorned wedding ring with the phrase, "Behold the end," engraved around an enameled skull set in the center. This is a message many modern couples might find problematic, but instead of the bad sitcom joke of marriage equals death, here it served as a reminder to the wearer to enjoy the love you have here and now while you're alive. While skulls and skeletons were the obvious and most common piece of imagery utilized to evoke death, it was by no means the only one. Even on pieces that depended on skulls as the central focus, they often incorporated snakes, bats, or a shovel and pickaxe, which are the tools of a gravedigger. Whether it was a ring, a bracelet, or a pendant, each singular piece of jewelry used a combination of imagery and inscription to convey and prove the wearer's absolute faith, thus freeing them from any need to fear their inevitable death. While I'm sure each carried a unique meaning for their long-deceased owners, there is one from the 1660s that really stands out as special to me. It's a small silver skull with Latin inscriptions that illustrate the popular view of death as both inevitable and something that should not be feared. And if that isn't enough, it opens to reveal not a tiny metal brain, but a tiny clock. The clock offers the wearer, and all of us, a reminder of the unpredictability of death. No matter what hour your clock strikes, it's always possible you might die! Okay, that catchphrase isn't as catchy as mine, but it is accurate. Time is precious, and it must not be wasted. Carrying this pocket watch was basically the 17th century version of getting a carpe diem tattoo. The popularity of memento mori jewelry largely overlaps with the popularity of remembrance or mourning jewelry. There are some key distinctions, however, between the two styles and their intended purposes. While memento mori jewelry was intended to serve as a reminder to the wearer to value their time on earth, mourning jewelry was designed to commemorate the death and the life lived by a loved one. Stylistically, the two have a lot in common. Both incorporate imagery commonly associated with death. However, mourning pieces usually included the name of the deceased, their dates of birth and death, and some sort of personal artifact, such as a piece of hair or even their cornea.
It's definitely a no for me, dog.
There are also some motifs that were more exclusively used in mourning jewelry, such as the serpent eating its own tail to symbolize the eternal nature of our souls and the memory of the deceased. While it is important to draw the distinction between them, these two death-centric styles are united in the emphasis on remembrance, either that of the deceased or our own mortality. Now, I know you might be thinking, dang, I wasn't planning on considering my own mortality this much on a Tuesday. But don't worry, it all comes back to the comforts of Halloween. The ideas presented in these memento mori pieces were also common in the world of Dutch fine arts. due to the Protestant majority in the Netherlands, artists in the region were not nearly as influenced by the Catholic Church as they likely were in the Catholic countries of France, Spain, or Italy. While it may have been seen as a disadvantage at the time because the Catholic Church was often the largest patron of the arts, it also gave these artists the freedom to explore themes that may have been more taboo in the Catholic Church at the time, like death. While the great Italian painters were creating huge, ornate pieces depicting religious scenes, Dutch painters in the early modern period simply painted what they saw. And what would any European living in an era in which it was safer to drink beer and whiskey than water see more than anything else? Well, death, of course! Thus, Vanitas was born. Inspired by a verse in the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, "Vanity of vanity, all is vanity." This was a style of still life painting popularized in the Netherlands that typically depicted sparsely arranged scenes of objects. The objects, which often included a skull, were intended to symbolize the inevitability of death and the transience and vanity of earthly accomplishments and pleasures. It was supposed to compel the viewer to consider their own mortality. Other objects often seen in Vanitas include candles, hourglasses, watches, rotting fruit, wilting flowers, and fraying books. While the Catholic Church may not have influenced Vanitas, this didn't mean religion didn't play at least some role. The movement center in the Netherlands meant that pieces often incorporated Calvinist themes, such as the innate depravity of humans and the importance of a strict moral code to prevent one from giving in to their true nature. Unfortunately, Vanitas declined in popularity in the mid-17th century, and ornate skull jewelry became less desired in the beginning of the 20th century. However, around that same time, the first mass production of Halloween decorations began thanks to the Denison Company of Massachusetts. It's here, at the turn of the century, that we can start to see how the Grim Reaper of medieval times morphed into the Memento Moris of the early modern period, which in turn led to the cheerful cardboard skeletons we hang up on Halloween.
Have dared to venture so far into the realms of night. Here in the twilight, between the world of the living and the world of the dead.
We'll dig deeper into the Denison Company and modern Halloween decor on the next episode. If there's something specific you want to learn about skeletons, death, Memento Mori, or Halloween in general, call into the All Hallows Hotline at 802-532-DEAD or write me an email at itsalwayshalloweenpodcast@gmail.com. You can also reach out on our Instagram page at itsalwayshalloweenpodcast. If you love It's Always Halloween, please subscribe on Patreon. We are 1 to 2 donations away from funding a third of the podcast. Our current patrons are producing 1 history episode and 2 Small Frights episodes a month. That's huge. Your support means more time for me to create even more material for you. You can find us at patreon.com/itsalwayshalloween. Or you can support the podcast by buying It's Always Halloween merch on Redbubble. That link is in our show notes and our Instagram as well. This episode of It's Always Halloween was performed by me, Luce Tomlin Brenner. It was co-researched and co-written by me and Isaac McDaniel. The editing, theme music, and sound design is by Pete Burns. Thanks, Pete. Make sure you check out Pete's brand new, incredible album, In Parallels, on his Instagram. You can follow him at Mittenberries, and you can follow me at LTB Comedy. I should also mention, it's not just on his Instagram. You can find it on Spotify, but a link is in his Instagram. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please subscribe and write us a little review so that other like-minded ghouls can find us. We're also on the NPR One app, So subscribe there and tell Ira Glass that you love us. Thanks so much for listening to It's Always Halloween. And come back next time, unless you stumble upon a corpse that was not buried 6 feet under. It happened to one of our listeners.